frozen cabins in the woods of Wisconsin aren't normally places where legendary music is born. But in the middle of winter 2 years ago, at one such cabin, the spirits of folk rock somehow came together to help Justin Vernon record a masterpiece. At that desolate, snowbound cabin, Vernon recorded the basic tracks for his CD, For Emma, Forever Ago. And that tiny little project ended up landing on many critics' best of 2008 lists. Vernon took the name Bon Hiver, French for good winter. But the person singing these songs doesn't sound like he was enjoying the season very much. This record is the sound of heartbreak.
Everything that happens is from now. This is pouring rain. This is paralyzed.
Fans of his story and his style have been clamoring for new music, and Justin Vernon is ready to oblige. A four-song EP by Bon Hiver comes out later this month. It's called Blood Bank, and Justin Vernon joins me now from WHWC in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
When did you write these new songs? Were they outtakes from your last album, For Emma, Forever Ago?
Yeah, actually, the title track, Blood Bank, was actually completely recorded and written during that same time, kind of amongst all those tracks that made it onto For Emma. But it just didn't seem to fit the story and the lineage, I guess. And so I had this tune that I really liked and that it felt right. So I just sort of surrounded Blood Bank with three other songs that were very different from one another, and they all kind of came together as this giant palate cleanser for the last record, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, let's hear a new track. It's the title track called Blood Bank.
That secret that we know, that we don't know how to tell. I'm in love with your honor. I'm in love with the chief. What's that noise up the stairs, babe? Is that Christmas morning?
You sing, I know it well, that secret that you know, that you don't know how to tell. Justin Vernon, what are you singing about here?
I don't know. I think this is a fictional kind of love story, I guess. And I think that when people are falling in love or when people are experiencing magical things, I guess, in their life, I think that secret is the answer to all those questions. You know, why is this sacred and why does this feel like larger than myself and larger than what I can even put into words, this experience like here on earth, if I can say that? I think that that's the secret. I think it's the connection that we have to each other.
When the snow started falling, we were stuck out in your car. You were rubbing both my hands, chewing on a candy bar. Like the present to be showing up like this. There's a moon when you crest. We started to kiss.
There are parts of this EP that are somewhat experimental. I'm thinking of a track called Woods. Mm-hmm. It's a cappella, and I think it uses an auto-tune machine mm-hmm. to sort of warp your voice. Let's listen mm-hmm. to some of that.
I'm up in the to slow down time.
And in that song, we hear some of the same lines repeated over and over, and some of the voices are added and subtracted, and a number of effects in the song. How did you decide to sort of come up with this piece?
It is kind of a piece more than it is a song, I guess. And it was just those words were just sort of a general incantation, a repetition, or a meditation, if you will, on my experience being away from everything. And so after I left the cabin, I sat down to finish this idea. And I think it was a an example of experimentation turning into something musical. This, for me, was a way to extend my voice or to experiment with different techniques or just sounds. It sort of was really freeing for me to do, and I'm really happy that it's the last song on the EP.
We're talking with Justin Vernon. He's with the band Bon Iver. His new four-song EP is called Blood Bank. Justin Vernon, let's go back a little bit to when you recorded your last album, For Emma, forever ago. What was happening in your life at that time?
Well, I had been living in North Carolina. I was sort of born and raised in Wisconsin, and I moved down there with all my bandmates. And basically, about a year into living down there, I had broken up with a girlfriend, and I got really, really sick with this kind of mono that attacked my liver. And it was really bizarre. I was in bed for 3 months, and it was during those 3 months I sort of took toll on the last 5 or 6 years previous of my life. And kind of a long story short, it was kind of telling me that I needed to leave there and to kind of become myself. And it was really difficult, basically leaving a marriage of a band that I'd been in for nearly 10 years. And I just sort of cut all ties, and I returned to Wisconsin, but to a new place, being my dad's cabin.
You didn't plan to write an album. You were really planning to just sort of hibernate and recover from the things you were going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It wasn't, I mean, I brought my musical gear with me because I thought, you know, it would be a smart idea to have it with me. But I think I was so confused. It was at a point in my life that I think everybody goes through where something needs to budge and something needs to change. And you can't really be aware of that because you're so within it. You're so in the present moment. And, that present moment seems to be constantly fleeting at the same time. And so it was an attempt to still my life, I think. I think you can lose track of your inner voice because there's so many people around, there's so many distractions, there's so many voices and influences. And for me, it was really beautiful to sort of reconnect with this person that I felt like I haven't really had that much quiet time with since I was a little boy.
And the story's all over you.
You recorded this album yourself in a basement of your dad's cabin in northern Wisconsin in the middle of winter, when you work in such a sort of an isolated environment and very few people to sort of bounce ideas off and to get feedback from. Were you able to get a sense that you were really putting something remarkable, really special together?
You know, it's hard to discuss that when you're in that moment. The whole thing was just sort of at an excavation site and just sort of digging and digging and building and building. I couldn't really be aware of any of that during that time.
Now, the critical reaction to this album has been extraordinary. I mean, you were just named Album of the Year by the British newspaper, The Observer. Did you expect this kind of reaction?
I mean, it would be silly to have thought of any of this happening. And it was almost silly to think anything would really happen. You know, my plan with the record was to make, you know, what I would usually do with records prior to that, make 500 to 1,000 copies, play shows and do that. And I never really even had that opportunity. By the time the record was done and I put it up on MySpace, the wheels were already moving. And it's beautiful and scary all at the same time.
You mentioned MySpace, and this is very much sort of a fan-driven story as well. Is it sort of scary to have fans come up to you and really sort of talk to you about the relationship that they have with this music that you wrote?
That part's the beautiful part for me. I don't know if I could give you a reason, you know, on a list of why I make music exactly, but that's definitely part of it. When somebody has an experience with something that you've done, and they share it with you, and it's important for them to share it with you, I think that's the circuit that you're looking for. You know, at that point, the circuit becomes complete, and you're no longer the songwriter, and they're no longer the listener. It's like this work has been done, and I really like that. And that's kind of what you live for, I guess.
There of course, been, you know, plenty of artists who receive massive critical acclaim after their first album, and then there's all this pressure to produce a sort of a second album. Do you feel like you sort of have to live up to that first album?
No, I don't. I feel fortunate in how this has all happened because I think I've learned some valuable lessons in how to really just operate your life, not even including how to operate a career in the music industry, so-called. I think that by writing this album, the Forema album, the way that I did, that was so kind of free of any influence, and I wasn't doing it for anybody but myself, I think that is something that I felt connected with when I was very young, when I first started playing music, while you first fall in love with rock music and what it does to you and the sort of unlatching and the freedom of it. I'm very, very still in knowing that all my job is to do is to sit down and to write songs. Mm. And I don't need to write those songs for any other reason than the good reasons.
Justin Vernon records under the name Bon Iver. His new EP comes out later this month. It's called Blood Bank. And he joined me from WHWC in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Justin Vernon, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's an honor.
You can hear plenty more of Bon Iver's music, including two entire live concerts at nprmusic.org.
Come on, skinny love, just let's sing it. Pour a little salt, we will never eat. My. Staring at the sink of blood across the needle.
Peel an onion and you'll most likely cry. Peel back the pages of The Onion newspaper and you'll probably laugh so hard you'll cry. The newspaper gives a refreshing perspective on current news events, most of which are satirical. So to predict which news stories are probably not going to make NPR headlines, or for that matter, CNN, Fox, or Al Jazeera, in 2009, the editor of The Onion, Joe Randazzo, joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Leanne.
Okay, 2008, big headlines, pirates, the election, the global economic and food crisis. What was your top story of 2008?
Well, we actually found 2008 to be a pretty uneventful year. The one thing that did seem to capture some of the nation's attention was there was an election for president of the United States. And that was actually so successful for NBC in particular that we're predicting that in 2009 they're actually going to re-release a new election just because the ratings were so high and it was so engaging. You know, they really only intended the series of the election to be 2.5 seasons long. But it was so popular that I think they're going to bring it back. A couple different things they could do is maybe have flashbacks with John McCain and Barack Obama when they were younger, sort of see what made them into the people that they are. Maybe bring in some new characters in 2009, the first Asian American president, for instance, or the first female president. So I think, you know, maybe if they can work in a cliffhanger, some sort of twist ending or something like that, they might have a very successful series, you know, this year as well with another presidential election. It was just too popular to pass up.
Well, you know, Jay Leno will have that spot in primetime. So, you know, they're going to have to fill it, right?
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting that he retired to 10 p.m.
Yeah.
So I guess people are going to bed earlier.
Maybe so. Well, you don't have enough money to stay up any later.
That's true. I'm not sure exactly how the logic of that works, but I'm sure that that is the case.
In 2008, we learned, among other things, the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull. What lessons do you think we should brace ourselves for in 2009?
Well, I think an important lesson that I'm going to be carrying into 2009 is stock up on kerosene and learn to wield a spear. Because I do think that one of the hot new trends we're going to see in the coming year is roving bands of kerosene pirates, you know, who are just kind of scavenging around trying to survive. And I think it's something that's going to appeal to children. They're going to be able to, you know, get outdoors and fight for their own food and survival. The elderly may not fare as well in 2009 if the economy, you know, continues to go the way it's going. But at least people will get out and get a good amount of exercise and really learn kind of what, you know, what it means to be living in a post-economic apocalyptic world.
I'm making my list. Kerosene, spears.
Spears. You can fashion your own spears from objects that you have just lying around the house. And if you do kill a bear, which you will probably need to do for sustenance, I would also recommend using the fur to kind of keep you warm during those cold winter months.
Okay. Let's talk about some people making headlines. I mean, of course, we had that election and that the new American president-elect Barack Obama. But there are other people. I mean, he's putting his team together. And one of the people during the campaign that put out a great video, very compelling, was Paris Hilton. Do you think that she might be picked for, I don't know, say, the president-elect's energy team?
I think she would actually make a very good Secretary of State. She has managed to win over the hearts and minds of the American public at large. And if she were to, you know, stroll into the Senate chamber with that adorable chihuahua of hers and just that certain joie de vivre and sophistication that she possesses, she might be able to win over the Senate and sort of wedge her way in there. Mm. If not that, I think Energy Secretary is a good guess, as good as any.
Hmm. Speaking of diplomatic affairs and foreign policy, do you think Brangelina will adopt a small country?
What we're predicting for 2009 is that Brad Pitt will actually become pregnant with quadruplets. It's the only way to top, I think, what they've already been up to.
Well, they did there was a pregnant man in 2008.
Right. And although I did a little research on that, and he's not actually a man. So it's a kind of a complex issue that might be hard for people to understand. But he's not totally a man. He does have a womb. It's not like Arnold in that movie where he had a baby. Okay. I think there's something a little fishy here.
Okay. What about music? I mean, do you think 2009 we'll hear some notable music? I mean, after all, Britney's back in the game.
Britney's back in the game. We're expecting classical music to make a huge resurgence. You know, Gregorian chants have not been popular for quite some time. And I think with, you know, all the new downloadability and MP3s and stuff like that, people in 2009 with the economy and this sort of dour pall that's been cast over the nation, I think they're going to want something a little more somber. And Gregorian chants seem to fit that niche.
So sitting next to my kerosene heater, holding my spear, chant will be what I want to listen to.
Yeah, you'll want to be listening to some Gregorian chants to lift your spirits.
Joe Randazzo is editor of The Onion, could you tell? And he joined us from our New York bureau to share your predictions on what next year's headlines are going to be. Go to npr.org/soapbox. Joe, thanks a lot and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. It's my pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Abraham Lincoln said, and in the end, it's not the years in your life that count. It's the life in your years. In this new year, we begin a series that focuses on the wisdom of older generations in a time of change. The ninth inning will feature people who've kept going long past retirement age. We begin with Chester Aaron. He's an 85-year-old garlic farmer from Occidental, California. You may have heard his garlic essays on NPR. Well, here's his essay about his life.
Remember Mae West? About 60 years ago, an interviewer asked her on radio, "Mae, if you had it all to do over, what would you do?" And Mae said, "If I had it to do all over, I'd do it all over you." My sentiments exactly. North Butler, Pennsylvania, 1930. I was 7 years old. Came home with cuts and bruises. told one of my five brothers I'd fought some kid who'd called me a Jew. That brother, Ray, was the only athlete in the family. Ray said, "You better learn to fight." By the time I was in high school, I was good enough to get to the finals in the Golden Gloves in Pittsburgh. My mother hated me wanting to be a boxer. My father said it was a good idea. Jews, he said, had to learn how to defend themselves. When my father was 14 in Russia, Cossacks came through his village. One of the Cossacks stabbed his pregnant sister. Papa grabbed a butcher knife and killed the Cossack. He ran and never saw his family again. When the war started in 1941, three of my brothers went off to fight. I wanted to go too. Every hour, every day, I heard what the Germans were doing to Jews. I wanted to kill Germans, but I had to stay home to help my parents. In 1943, I volunteered. I ended up a heavy machine gunner in an armored infantry unit. I was with the troops that liberated Dachau. When I came home, my mother and father were dead. My father had died in an insane asylum. I went to California and, thanks to the GI Bill, went to college, UCLA. A professor said I would be a writer someday. From that day on, that was all I wanted to do, write stories and novels. I married an Irish Catholic woman in Berkeley and made my living as an X-ray technician. As an X-ray technician, I discovered that hospitals all over the country, for no legitimate reason, were over-radiating what were then referred to as Negro patients. I tried to publicize the fact, tried to get the practice stopped. I was fired. Unable to find hospital work, I went back to school, earned my master's degree, and was hired by St. Mary's College. I was a professor there for 25 years. I retired to a life of farming, garlic, and writing. 5 years ago, at the age of 80, I sent a four-page vita to 30 agents, describing all my publications and awards. I received one response. She said, "Let's face it, Mr. Aaron, you are 80 years old. Why should I waste my time and money on you?" Since then, I have published a collection of stories and two novels, and I have a new novel coming out next year. That's why.
85-year-old Chester Aaron of Occidental, California. To learn more about Chester and to share your own life stories, go to npr.org/soapbox. Coming up next week on The Ninth Inning, a conversation with dancer Dorothy Toy Fong, also known as the Chinese Ginger Rogers, who at 91 years of age is still dancing.
I believe in adaptation.
I believe in a silver lining.
I believe that being flexible keeps me going.
I believe every single person deserves to be acknowledged.
This I believe.
Our This I Believe essay today was sent in by Gina Perosa, who lives on a farm in La Center, Washington. She and her husband have other jobs, too, but on the farm they raise hay and keep horses. The horses led Perosa to write about her belief. Here's our series curator, independent producer, Jay Allison.
Gina Perosa wrote her essay right after what she says was one of the worst nights of her life. It was a moment she realized that one of her beliefs had limits, and it was up to her to set them. Here is Gina Perosa with her essay for This I Believe.
The architectural term pathways of desire refers to dirt ruts in the grass that people make when they want a shortcut between prescribed routes. If you have a yard, you probably have at least a few of them. I live on a farm, and we have dozens. The path between the doghouse and the porch, the tight corner around the house on the south side, horse trails, the line between one gate and the next. I'm a firm believer in protecting pathways of desire, but I believe we have to be careful of them, too. On one hand, I hate rules. I'm pretty creative about finding ways around them, and I always think twice about thwarting those of others. I respect desire in my children and in the animals on my farm. Their pathways look to me like individual choices, and I respect those. But my respect is double-edged, because pathways of desire can also lead us into trouble. Lately, a pathway of desire has led our horses across what are supposed to be impassable barriers, the cattle guards. They want to come into our yard to eat green grass and apples off the trees before the family can. I understand this desire, even though I feed them bales of hay every day, and it ought to be enough. Well, Saturday night, our oldest horse fell while leaping the cattle guard and broke his hip. We had to put him down and have his carcass hauled away. The other horses watched the drama unfold. Did they learn anything? No. Today they're back in the yard. Thwarting pathways of desire is a constant concern of planners and architects and farmers, too. I'm going to have to pull out and enlarge our cattle guards, excavate deeply under them, paint them bright yellow, and pull a strand of electric fence across them until the horses understand that their pathway of desire isn't available to them anymore. This is hard for me. It goes against my nature, but sometimes I need to modify my belief based on what I've learned. I realize that as a mother, a farmer, and wife, I sometimes must go along with the rules. For instance, my husband and I disagree on a lot. Religion, politics, we don't like the same music. While our pathways of desire might breach our relationship, we put up a cattle guard and we stay obediently on our own sides. It mostly works. Boundaries are necessary sometimes. Enforcing them takes a lot more effort than it ought to. I believe you have to choose your pathway of desire with care. Get it wrong, and the consequences might be fatal. My old horse and I learned this the hard way.
Gina Perosa with her essay for This I Believe. Perosa told us that the snow has been so deep lately that it covered the cattle guards, and the horses began crossing them again. She and her husband had to put the electric fence back up. As we enter the new year, we want to repeat our invitation to write an essay for our series and submit it at npr.org. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison.
Jay Allison is co-editor with Dan Gettiman, John Gregory, and Vicki Merrick of the book This I Believe, Volume 2, More Personal Philosophies of Remarkable Men and Women.
Support for This I Believe comes from Prudential Retirement.
Dozen boys and girls between the ages of 7 and 11 are practicing in the rehearsal room of a concert hall in Salt Lake City. They're halfway through a year-long tour of more than 200 concerts that will take them to nearly every state in the nation. When the tour is over, they will return home to some of the poorest places in Africa and to a new life, one that's very different from the one they left behind. In this week's What's in a Song from the Western Folklife Center, we feature the African Children's Choir and its mission to rescue young lives by harnessing the power of music.
My name is Nalugo Patience. I'm 9 years old from Uganda. Papa is out in the field. Mama is down at the well. Run miles away at the market.
The song talks about how life is in Africa. It is the responsibility of a whole community to raise up a child. My name is Chimera Victor, 26 years old, and I am currently a chaperone with the African Children's Choir. When I was growing up, anyone had the right to discipline you. It didn't have to be your parent or your relative. It just had to be someone who was an elder in the village, someone older than you in the village. If they found you doing something wrong, it was upon them to correct you and make sure you were doing the right thing. So that's how it goes. It takes a whole village to raise a child.
Nachikuwa kijiji kizima mle ya mutoto. That's the Swahili way of saying it takes a whole village to raise a child.
Okay, this is how it works. The organization will go to the most needy places We're talking about communities that have been hit by poverty and stricken by disease and war. And the children are brought into a training academy where they are trained for about maybe 4 months before they join the choir. Then they will tour for about between 12 to 15 months. Then afterwards, they will go back to the Music for Life Center where they will have their education. In my case, I was living at an orphanage and they carried out an audition and was chosen to join the choir. I went on tour when I was about 9 years old, and when I was done with tour, I went back home and Music for Life paid for my tuition fees all the way till university. I graduated in 2006 and I decided to come back and volunteer and work with the choir as a chaperone.
When I came in the choir, they taught us how to dance and to sing. I have learned to speak English. I have learned to tell people about the gospel of God through singing. And I have learned how to read.
This is what goes through my mind when I see the children sing. For example, patience. I know that life ahead for them is good because I've gone through the program, and I know, looking at myself now, I know there's hope, there's a future for them that lies ahead of them, and it's theirs for the taking.
What's in a Song is produced by Hal Cannon and Taki Telenitis of the Western Folklife Center. To learn more about the African Children's Choir and to see pictures of Patience and Victor, visit our website at nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Our feature, What's in a Song, is produced with support from the George S. and Dolores Dory Eccles Foundation.
There are points on the timeline of American military history where the tables turned. The 2007 surge in the current war in Iraq is a recent example. William Tecumseh Sherman's March to the Sea in 1864 is another. The Union General's campaign after the capture of Atlanta, Georgia, to the taking of Savannah has provided an unending source of material for Civil War historians, including Noah Andre Trudeau. Longtime listeners know him as Andy, our Oscar music guy, but Trudeau is an award-winning writer, and Southern Storm, Sherman's March to the Sea is his latest tome. He's in the studio. It's really nice to see you again, Andy.
Great to see you, Leanne.
Paint that picture for us. Atlanta is burning. Lincoln has been reelected president, and William Tecumseh Sherman convinces the president and General Grant that he can take a huge contingent of men and arms, cease communication, and march to Savannah. How did he convince them?
He counted a lot on his friendship with Grant. This really was the partnership that I think won the Civil War. These two men, Grant in charge in the East, Sherman in charge in the West, intimately trusting each other. Grant had come in and said, what we've got to do is smash the enemy's armies. Here is Sherman in September of 1864 saying, you know, I think the best thing I can do is turn my back on the biggest enemy army near me and march to the sea. You know, to me, the great success of this campaign was the logistical achievement. He had to move 60,000 men, almost 3,000 wagons, and what blows my mind, 5,000 cattle, across 300 miles, seven major river crossings with no bridges. And he did it.
He waged total war. Beans and bullets is a phrase that is used. Was total destruction in Georgia the goal or the byproduct?
It was a byproduct. Sherman was really trying to do a number of things. On a tactical level, he was moving 60,000 men from Atlanta to the sea where they would be more useful to Grant. On a practical level, he had to feed these guys. Ultimately, he was really showing to Southern civilians that the Confederacy could not protect them. And he was showing to Southern soldiers that no one was protecting their loved ones, and the sooner they ended this war, the better.
In feeding and supplying his men, did that get out of hand?
Yes and no. You know, if you abandoned your house, it would likely get looted. If somebody fired a gun from your house is probably toast. But for a lot of them, especially the ones who wrote a lot of the memoirs, when you really look past the story they're telling, you realize that after Sherman's army left, they still had their home. They still had some foodstuffs. I mean, there was no widespread starvation in Georgia in the winter of 1864-65. So, yes, it had a tremendous impact, but it was not the kind of catastrophic, scouring operation that I think people often assume it was.
Another story about this march, the army was followed by legions of slaves who were being freed. Was this a march to free the slaves?
Sherman was adamant that the last thing he wanted was a large procession of African Americans following after his armies. He was willing to take the young, strong guys. He could use them to build roads and cut down trees and do those sorts of things. But he didn't want the children, the women. But look, this was freedom. It was there for the first time in many of their lives, and a large number of them just dropped everything and followed the armies.
For Sherman's benefit, nobody ever knew where he was, even though he had this large army with him. Part of it was there was no press. And so he becomes a mythical figure from the beginning. What was his last word on the march?
Years later, when everyone was really obsessed with the march, he really tried to discourage their interest. He follows the march up with a second campaign where he proceeds through South Carolina, North Carolina, and winds up ending the war outside of Raleigh. He said, look, if the march through the Carolinas was a 10, my march to the sea was a 1. And he got to hate all the little things that came along with it. I mean, whenever he popped up to speech, there'd be a band somewhere cranking away, marching through Georgia. The song really encapsulated a lot of the popular mythology around the march and a sense of good spirit that I don't know necessarily that the soldiers felt, but was certainly then ascribed to them.
After all the time you've spent with him, what's your lasting impression of the man?
He was brilliant in a way. He was twisted in a way. He had a very strange set of values, and he hated the fact that this great equality was sweeping the nation. Not only African-American, he was not a big fan of African-Americans as equal citizens, but in a way he believed in a social hierarchy, that there were people meant to rule and there were people meant to be ruled. And he hated the fact that the common soldier could run for office, could have positions of importance. The great irony was he was an instrument of this change, and I think years later probably came to regret all those changes and maybe never quite understood the role he played in making them happen.
Noah Andre Trudeau's newest book on the Civil War is called Southern Storm, Sherman's March to the Sea. It's published by HarperCollins. Andy, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Leanne.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.